From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, Christopher Conover brings us a preview of the issues that have top priority with the Arizona State Legislature as they begin their 2008 session. The Bush administration was expected to make a decision this week on the listing of polar bears as an endangered species, a decision which could have a major effect on the global warming debate. I'll talk to Kieran Suckling from the Center for Biological Diversity to find out the latest. Right here in Tucson, there's a working post office that also houses a treasure trove of U.S. postal history and Civil War memorabilia. Bill Mortimer will take us on a tour. And Soo-Young Lee brings us a profile of the Tucson Symphony Orchestra's principal percussionist, Omero Cerrone, and his world of sound and rhythm. That's all coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. Members of the Arizona Legislature have been meeting this week to discuss ways to plug a nearly billion-dollar hole in the state's budget. One area getting close attention is the current budget of the University of Arizona, and we'll get the details next from Christopher Conover.
When the gavel falls on Monday to signify the opening of this year's legislative session, state lawmakers will begin their work with a shadow looming over them, more specifically, a hole to the tune of nearly $1 billion in the current budget. The legislature and governor became aware of the budget shortfall in the summer, nearly as soon as the budget year began. But no work to fix the problem began until now, nearly 6 months into the fiscal year. Plugging the hole in the budget is made more difficult by the fact that many state-funded programs cannot be touched due to voter mandates or other legal reasons. So all available state dollars are getting a very close look. Tucson State Representative Phil Lopez is a member of the Appropriations Committee and the House Minority Leader.
The chairman of both the House and Senate Appropriations Committees, they have come up with a list of options, and it's just everything. There's literally hundreds of items on there that they're presenting to us as a list of potential cuts. Many of them, although I don't think most, many of them are items that got additional money last year. They got additional money when we passed the budget in 07. So they're going back and using the adage first in, last in, first out. So if you got funded late in 07, you're going to get looked at.
Representative Lopez says one area receiving increased scrutiny is the state university system.
The universities are not terribly popular here. Many people feel that we're spending way too much money on universities.
The initial recommendation from the two chairmen of the budget committees was that the universities each take a mid-year 10% cut. At the University of Arizona, that would mean an immediate loss of $44 million. University of Arizona President Dr. Robert Shelton says he told committee members that's not realistic.
We operate very differently than a lot of agencies. We make a commitment to students July last year for the whole academic year. We already have our classes in place. A lot of people have worked very hard to make sure we do have the classes so we can graduate kids on time.
Dr. Shelton said one of the things that makes the budget cuts even more difficult to deal with is the success of the university.
We pushed the 80% mark for first-year retention this last fall, so we have a lot more students coming back, which is good news, but we've got to find seats for them. So this fiscal year, I told the committee, with due respect, the committees, that I don't see how we could deal with a budget cut of the nature that they're looking at.
However, the budget woes do not end when state lawmakers determine how to solve the current shortfall. Once they complete that task, they must turn to next year's budget. And the financial picture for the 2008-2009 fiscal year is anything but rosy. So President Shelton is preparing for a cut for next year.
Going into 2009, there are a number of things we could do, and we're examining those closely. None of them, of course, is advantageous to our students, and so it's going to be a discussion.
The 10% cut to the universities is certainly worrisome, but President Shelton says he's confident that the proposal is just a place to begin the discussion. Back at the Capitol, Representative Lopez is trying to assure everyone that he'll do his best to make sure the president's feelings prove to be correct.
Those of us who support the universities are going to fight very hard to make sure that they're held harmless or at least as safe as possible.
The final player in the budget discussion is the governor, and in the plan she put forward, the universities are safe, and she must approve any plan from the legislature before it's put in motion. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
The road to having the polar bear classified as an endangered species has been a long one, even as scientists have been able to conclusively prove that the bear's habitat is shrinking due to the warming of the Arctic. Political opposition to recognizing the cause of the warming has been a roadblock. The Center for Biological Diversity is headquartered in Tucson, but their concerns are global. I asked the group's policy director, Kieran Suckling, to bring us up to speed on the situation.
Yeah, I mean, basically what happened was there was a proposal to list the polar bears endangered last January. That started a public comment period. Over 600,000 people wrote in saying this thing should be listed. The decision was due last Wednesday. The government's now saying it's going to miss that decision. We have threatened to sue them to keep them on the right timeline, and we hope that we will finally get a absolute decision within the next month or so.
So what do you think the administration is waiting for?
Well, that's a good question, because when this process started, the government went to the U.S. Geological Service, which is a government agency, and said, we want you to go and study polar bear science and advise us on what should be done. So last September, the Geological Survey issued 9 reports on the polar bear, saying in no uncertain terms, it's endangered, so it should be listed. Now the administration is saying, we need more time to understand this report. Well, the report came out in September. Several of the authors of the report have expressed dismay, saying, what is there to understand? If it's endangered, it's endangered. You should move forward. So I don't think the question now is scientific at all. The question is really political. I think that the administration will list it, but what they're doing is crafting a message to say, we're listing it, it's endangered, but this has no implications for greenhouse gas policy. This has no implications for regulating global warming. Effectively, we're not going to do anything.
And the crux of this matter is the connection that the scientists are able to make between greenhouse gases, global warming, and the polar bear's loss of habitat.
Yeah, exactly. The polar bear spends almost its entire life on sea ice. It's the only place it hunts from. And as the globe has warmed, we've seen a catastrophic decline in the amount of sea ice during the summer in the Arctic. In fact, this year, 2007, was the lowest ever recorded. So, and they know that that's closely correlated with greenhouse gases. So if you're declaring the polar bear is endangered because of sea ice loss is caused by greenhouse gases and global warming, then the conclusion is we must take action on greenhouse gases. That is where the Bush administration wants to draw a line and say, no, it's endangered, but we don't have to do that. And they've come up with some arguments so far, which are really just not terribly coherent. They've said on the one hand, well, our scientists don't have the expertise to deal with that. Well, if U.S. government scientists don't have the expertise to deal with global warming, then who in the world does? Secondly, they've tried to say that somehow global warming greenhouse gases are outside the scope of the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act says you will address and stop any threat to a species, doesn't matter what it is.
Well, best case scenario, what kind of difference would listing the polar bears make in protecting them?
Quite a bit. Once a species is endangered, the federal government must designate critical habitat for it. That would be the Arctic, effectively. And then it is not allowed to take any action which will either drive the species extinct or destroy its critical habitat. So I'll give you a good example of how this comes into play. Right at this very moment, The federal government is in the process of issuing new oil leases in the Arctic at a place called the Chukchi Sea, which are going to continue spewing out greenhouse gases and melt the Arctic. If the polar bear was listed today, that decision would have to be reviewed under the Endangered Species Act. The federal government would not be permitted to issue those oil leases if it was determined that that was going to contribute to the Arctic melting, which it is. In fact, this is a very big concern we have, is they're delaying the protection decision, and then they're going full steam ahead with these oil leases in the Arctic. They're actually going to go to auction February 6th. So it looks like they're going to auction off those leases, then list the polar bear and probably try to say, well, it's too late to go back and review the auction. We already did it.
So what's the prognosis for the polar bear without any governmental protection?
Its extinction, what the scientists are saying is that by 2050, we'll have an ice-free Arctic during the summer. So that means all of the habitat the polar bear needs is gone by 2050. That will result in about two-thirds of all polar bears being wiped out by 2050, including all U.S. polar bears. A third will remain for some time in Greenland and probably the Soviet Union, but those are predicted to disappear by the end of the century. So it's an absolute extinction trajectory unless we can do something rapidly.
Who is standing alongside the Center for Biological Diversity in filing this lawsuit?
The two groups we've been working with primarily are the Natural Resources Defense Council and Greenpeace, which are two large international environmental groups. And so they've joined us in this and have been really tremendously helpful in getting the word out and mobilizing the American public to get involved in this. And it has been precedent-setting. We have 600,000 people writing letters to the government on an endangered species issue, really on any environmental issue, is staggering.
Can you tell our listeners how the public can get involved in this issue now?
Yeah, there are a couple ways to do it. You can go to the Center for Biological Diversity's website, which is www.endangeredearth.org. And from there, you can quickly jump to sign a petition to tell the government right now that stop delaying, let's issue this decision. And then secondly, you know, anyone who wants to pick up the phone and call the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which has an office right here in Tucson, and say, what is going on? Why is this decision being delayed? Let's get this thing done. Both of those would help dramatically.
What kind of track record do suits like this against the government have?
They have a very good track record. We've won approximately 93% of our suits in terms of endangered species. And it's not because we're rocket scientists, but the law is very well written, and especially in regards to saying that all of your decisions have to be based solely on the best science available. And so in most cases, when we go to court, we're saying, look, here are your own government scientists telling you, protect the species, protect the habitat. Here's a memo from an agency bureaucrat in D.C. refusing to do so. Well, and under that kind of scenario, a judge is going to say, clearly the science is on the side of conservation. And so the law itself, I think, is one that helps people who have an interest in science and seeing that decisions are made on a scientific basis.
The Center for Biological Diversity expects the Bush administration to make a decision on the polar bear status by March. If they fail to do so by that time, the lawsuit will be filed. Kieran Suckling says that one alternative, classifying the polar bear as a threatened species rather than endangered, won't be enough. The lawsuit demands full protection status for the polar bear. Coming up in the second half of Arizona Spotlight, a visit to a museum right here in Tucson that documents the story of the U.S. postal system. And here's some rhythm from the Tucson Symphony's lead percussionist, Omero Cerrone. Those stories next on Arizona Spotlight. There's a post office in Tucson that is also home to some fascinating exhibits about the history of the U.S. mail service and Civil War memorabilia. The Postal History Foundation serves as the Center for Postal Research and Education in the Southwest. And next, Bill Mortimer will take us on a visit.
The Postal History Foundation is perhaps one of the best-kept secrets in Tucson. The foundation is a privately funded nonprofit and an IRS-designated charitable organization. I can't really imagine it being a secret. It is a hub of postal research and education here in the Southwest. It maintains the largest and one of the finest facilities dedicated to postal history in the western United States and is also the only philatelic museum that operates an extensive youth education program. A full-service branch post office operates alongside a display of a turn-of-the-century post office with authentic fittings which illustrate beautifully the post office on the frontier. Bob Bechtel is chairman of the Postal History Foundation.
The Postal History Foundation is an organization started about 1960 for the purpose of using philately, collecting stamps and things like that, as a part of youth education. Our main thrust is to be in the schools to introduce children to the historical value of stamps. And of course, when people have something they can handle, take in their hands and look at, they remember things better. So we can use stamps for all kinds of courses. History is an obvious one.
Adjacent to the post office building is the Peggy J. Slusser Library. It was dedicated by the parents of Peggy Slusser, also stamp collectors, as a monument to their daughter and her stamp collecting.
Peggy was a person who collected, and she was interested in the Civil War. And her parents, of course, helped her in this. And so she was a serious collector and scholar in the Civil War period. She became fascinated with the Civil War. And so she has books, and she has like Civil War caps of soldiers and a pike. It's not really a bayonet, but it's like a bayonet, and other things like that. So they wanted to preserve her collection here. And so that's why we have this exhibit case here that goes 3/4 the length of this room.
Bob, you told me there are some 40 volunteers, and I noticed several working throughout the building.
Most of the volunteers will be involved in these stamps that are given to us. Now, people will give us letters, they'll give us collections, they'll give us correspondence, all kinds of things. Now, a lot of the people are involved in what is called soaking, and we make a joke out of this. So they soak the stamps so that they can come off the paper of the envelopes and things like that. Now, of course, you're aware that we're now getting to the point where you can't do that so much anymore. So we're in a dilemma. What are we going to do? Just cut the squares and leave the paper around the edge or whatever? And you're even getting stamps where the ink will come off if you try to soak it too much. There are many changing periods in the production of stamps. So the volunteers will break down collections, they'll soak stamps off, they'll classify them. All those drawers that you see were filled by volunteers. They count the stamps by hundreds and put them in there, and then prepare lessons for the children. Now currently it's probably 6,000 students that we give materials to. And we give the stamps out free, and we even give them free albums that they can put the stamps in.
And having a branch post office in the building is certainly a benefit.
We always want to be able to supply mint stamps to people, of course, who are collectors, and people still come and will buy stamps here. And, of course, it also serves the local population. We, you know, like every post office, we get overwhelmed at Christmas time.
I can see how the neighborhood might want to keep this post office a secret. There are no lines, yet it's a full-service postal facility. Bob Bechtel, before we leave you, I wanted to ask about the paintings by Cal Peterson that line the wall of this beautiful library. You said they had been stored in the basement of the Historical Society for some 20 years?
We were in the cellar of the Historical Society. Well, Cal Peters heard about us and so on, and so he made these paintings, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, of mail robberies. So the biggest one there is a train robbery.
Bob Bechtel, chairman of the Postal History Foundation, who also teaches psychology at the University of Arizona. Thank you. I'm Bill Mortimer for Arizona Spotlight.
If you'd like to see the exhibits at the Postal History Foundation, or if you just need stamps, they're located at 920 North 1st Avenue, just south of Speedway, and they're open from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday through Friday. Sometimes, as a percussionist in an orchestra, you have to wait as long as an hour just to play one very quick note on a triangle. But that's only one small part of the job, as we'll discover next about Homero Cerón. He's the principal percussionist for the Tucson Symphony Orchestra, and this segment was produced by Soo-Yun Lee.
I don't care who you talk to, whether it's a boy or a girl, or old or young, or whether they come from Africa or China, or it doesn't matter. Hitting things is always fun. My name is Homero Cerón, and I'm the principal percussionist with the Tucson Symphony Orchestra. I was born and raised in Monterrey, Mexico. I came to the United States as an 18-year-old. My biggest influence as a kid came from my sister, and she was already playing a lot of piano. I asked my parents if I could take the lessons too. Unfortunately, some of the other boys in the neighborhood started making fun of me because they said that playing the piano was for sissies. And I did not want to be a sissy, so I took up the drums. The percussion player in the orchestra is the person who plays the cymbals, the gongs, the xylophone, the bells, all of the kinds of drums, including the kettle drums and the chimes, and any other thing that you shake or scrape or strike, either with your bare hands or with a beer. Percussion instruments really inject a lot of flavor into the music. You probably would agree with me that a big climax in a piece of music would not be the same if you did not have that big sound. Since the percussion player is always a soloist, even if you play the tambourine or the triangle, if you miss the part, or if you play too loud or too soft, really, you can affect the music in a great way. Very often in the orchestra, we end up spending a lot of time counting bars. You sit there sometimes for hundreds of bars at a time, so you pretty much need to know the score and still count your bars and make sure that you understand your cues, whether the cues come from the oboe, the flute, the trumpet, and know where you are in the score, so you get up at a certain time and be ready to play your note. Sometimes it's only two or three notes. And say, for example, if you were playing Bruckner's 8th Symphony, you have to wait a long time just to play one triangle roll. The big advantage of playing percussion is that your life varies a lot, because some concerts I'm playing triangles, some concerts I'm playing snare drums, some concerts I'm playing xylophone, and sometimes we even have to bring instruments that I have never played before in my life, because that's what the percussionist is expected to do. This is a jawbone. This came from Peru, and the jawbone rattles. Conga, I usually like to play on the floor. Djembe. This is the talking drum. Dumbek. Here, which is actually not used as a drum, it is a drum, but it has a stick fastened to the drum head. So what we do We use a wet rag. We rub the stick. And we produce that sound. Some people refer to it as the lion's roar. It can be a hyena. It can be a monkey. And often they ask me, don't you get bored playing in the orchestra? You hardly even play, you know? And so I also have a good time teaching them or making them see the great satisfaction in only playing once in a while, but being so important and making such a big impact in the music. Perhaps the next time, if you come to the symphony, you might have a little bit of more appreciation for what we percussion players do in the back of the orchestra.
If you'd like to hear more of Homero Cerrone's work with the Tucson Symphony, their 2008 season is going strong. George Hansen conducts and plays piano in concerts tonight, Saturday, and Sunday of music by Brahms and Mozart. We have a link to the full schedule online at KUAZ.org. And now here's Stephanie Varney with this week's Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
If you love discovering new cuisine, get ready for the Tucson Slow Food Film Festival that is happening all around town this weekend. Some of the many events taking place are a brunch at the restaurant Villa Thai Cuisine on January 12th from 12 to 1:30 p.m., then later that day at 2:15 p.m. at the PCC Center for Performing Arts, there will be screenings of new films followed by a talk given by Maribel Alvarez. Sunday, January 13th, from 6 to 9 p.m., the Lowe's Ventana Canyon Resort is hosting the closing gala for the festival that will have dinner containing organic foods and wines. Is your vinyl collection looking a little sparse? Then check out the 2008 Hotel Congress Record Festival. On Saturday, January 12th, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., local vendors and independent dealers will be at Hotel Congress to sell rare, new, and used records from a variety of genres. The Harlem Globetrotters are bouncing their way to Tucson for their Magic as Ever basketball tour. This event will take place at the Tucson Arena at 2 p.m. this Sunday afternoon. The Tucson Medical Center Marshall Auditorium is hosting an event called Sand Spirits, a workshop. This workshop teaches about ways to use signs and symbols in nature. This event is happening on Saturday, January 12th, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Stephanie Varney.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. Thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, from the University of Arizona. It is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood, with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. Most of the music heard on our program, including the theme, was written and performed by Calexico. I'm Mark McLemore.